You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. This morning we have some very interesting conversation ahead of us. The med tech world in Orange County is growing, and med tech in LA at UCLA is growing. And we have today Parag God, the CEO from Spinex, and Reggie Edgerton on the Department of Neurobiology at UCLA. So welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about Spinex and its connection to neurobiology.
Okay, Parag, you want to start that?
Spinex is a spin-off out of UCLA, led by, based on the work done by Reggie and company for several decades. Spinex is developing a non-invasive spinal cord stimulator called Tescon, which is focused on delivering electrical pulses into the spinal cord in a completely non-surgical manner. The basic idea behind the device is all functions, including movement, autonomic function, including bladder bowel function, cardiovascular function, breathing, are controlled by the spinal cord. The brain gives you the basic command to go and or not to go. After an injury, such as a spinal cord injury or a stroke or a natural condition such as cerebral palsy or Parkinson's, the dysfunction that is caused can be reversed or to a certain extent improved using electrical stimulation of the spinal cord, wherein you can retrain the circuits present in the spinal cord and to further improve function. This has been research done, led by Reggie at UCLA for the last 30 plus years.
So Reggie, tell us about what that means to you.
Well, the basic idea is that we have learned some features of how our nervous system controls all of these different organs. And after an injury, for example, we've focused in large part initially on spinal cord injury. And the question is, how can we recover from paralysis? And the basic idea is after the trauma, there is a lot of function left in the spinal cord. The big problem is getting the communication between the brain and the spinal cord. And our basic idea is to take advantage of what the spinal cord can do, even independent of the brain. Mm-hmm. And we have been developing that capability for several decades. And in the last decade, there's been a lot of things, ideas that have come together. And it's been pretty obvious from the experiments that we've done in the last 10 years that some of these observations need to be moved to human subjects. Most of the data were derived from animal experiments. But the only way to do that is you have to have a commercially successful track in order to get the new technology to our patients. And so that's where we are now. We have lots of ideas of how to improve multiple functions from different traumas and different disorders, sensory motor disorders. But the big challenge is now to raise a sufficient amount of money and to carry out all the processes that's necessary to get FDA approval. And that's where Parag led the effort to form the company Spinex.
How much money are you looking for?
We're looking at raising anywhere between $5 to $7 million to take us from where we are right now, which is at a pre-clinical trials phase when we're looking at getting FDA approval. And that $5 to $7 million will take us all the way through approval of our device through the FDA.
Then will you be able to sell and generate revenue from that?
So that leads us to two independent steps. Like Reggie said, the same device has the capability to potentially impact multiple functions and multiple pathologies. The way FDA functions is we'll need to gain approval for one indication for one particular indication for use at a given time. So once that first approval is in place, it allows us to kick off two independent tracks. One, start selling the device and generating revenue for that particular indication. And in this case, our first indication that we're targeting is urinary incontinence and bladder dysfunction. And simultaneously, it allows us to start approaching subsequent indications, which are cerebral palsy and Parkinson's disease, you know, from our on our roadmap. So with this particular raise, it will get us to a couple of different milestones.
So when you talk about trauma in the spinal cord, are you talking about paraplegia, things like that as well?
So trauma is a more general term being used. A trauma could be in the brain, such as a stroke. It could be in the spinal cord, such as a spinal cord injury that could cause paraplegia or tetraplegia. Or it could be something like multiple sclerosis, which is all over the nervous system, spinal cord and brain. A third form could be trauma to the peripheral nerves, such as brachial plexus. So that's why trauma is being used as a more general term. Based on studies done so far, we've shown that the same technology is applicable across different conditions, different forms of trauma, because the basic idea being that all of these functions are controlled by the spinal cord, and by allowing us to reactivate these spinal circuits, we can restore function, and it's not dependent on where the trauma is actually occurring.
Are you thinking that at some point you'll be able to restore paraplegics like Christopher Reeves?
We have, based on clinical studies done at UCLA, we've already demonstrated this in a group of individuals that were paraplegic, where we could restore the ability to stand independently within a couple of sessions of the treatment, which gets stronger as they continue to train. Individuals with quadriplegia or tetraplegia that have lost hand and arm function, we've been able to restore the ability to use their hands and arm as part of activities of daily living within 4 weeks of training. Yes, that is definitely one of the targets for us.
So talk a little bit about the therapy or the technique. I mean, is this a large machine? Is this something that attaches to the body? Tell us a little bit about what the protocols would be.
So this is a wearable device, which a patient can wear on their waist or on a lanyard around their neck. There are a couple of wires that lead out from the device and get hooked onto the patient's back and hips or the neck, depending on what you're targeting. The protocol itself is relatively straightforward. Most of these patients, be it stroke or spinal cord injury, routinely undergo physical therapy or rehab at a center several days a week. This gets easily integrated into their existing therapy protocols, wherein we turn on the device while the patients are undergoing some of these therapies with what are called as activity-based therapies. So we want to, it acts as an amplifier of ongoing activity. So based on what activities they're doing, this allows them to further amplify those signals, as well as exponentially accelerate the rate at which recovery could occur. Any therapy protocol would last from 1 to 2 hours a day and could be done 4 to 5 days a week. A second part of our therapy protocol that we're developing right now is integrating the same stimulation paradigm into activities of daily living, such as for a patient who is has some level of function, and they're using their hands and arms for routine activities of daily living, could they integrate the stimulation into that such that they could perform their activities of daily living in a more efficient manner and a more productive manner? So those are both directions that we are simultaneously targeting.
So you have the device ready or only a prototype?
We have multiple devices built, what we call as an alpha prototype. These are devices that are based on engineering devices built in the lab that were outsourced to a product development firm. So yes, we have devices built that are currently undergoing clinical studies in different parts of the country right now. We are in the process of building what we call as our final clinical device, and we're expecting delivery of these devices in the next couple of months. Those are the devices that we'll be using for our eventual FDA trials before we submit it for approvals.
How long will the FDA trials be?
The protocol itself is about 12 to 14 weeks long. And this is, like I said, indicated towards bladder dysfunction in individuals with neurogenic bladder. So bladder dysfunction caused by stroke or spinal cord injury. So the trial itself is 12 weeks. 12-week therapy period with two sessions a week, each session lasting for about an hour a day. The total period for which the trial will be ongoing would be about 6 to 8 months to complete all of the patients required for to complete the study.
And the end of 6 months, then you submit to FDA?
That is the intention, yes.
So within a year, you might be on the marketplace?
A little longer than that. There are several aspects prior to us initiating the trial that needs to be done. A lot of it is engineering testing of the device, which it takes time. And a lot of these are done by third-party companies that in an unbiased way. So once the device is built and ready, there's a lot of engineering testing done in-house to ensure that it's delivering the kind of pulses in a safe and efficient manner, and there's no, there are no issues being that are observed. Along with that, we have patients and clinicians try it out to make sure that they're satisfied with how it's functioning, and if they want any changes to it. So there's a lot of user feedback that we receive. Once a lot of that is worked out, that's when they undergo what's called verification and validation testing, which are comparing it to basic standards to ensure that it's a safe device. So it's a lot of back end work done on the engineering benchtop that takes a lot longer than just the clinical trial.
So Reggie, tell me about this. Must be exciting for you to take all the time that you've been working in the academic world and seeing it being applied.
Yeah, it is. When I started on this track, actually in the 70s, with basically a central idea, is most people did not realize how important the spinal cord itself is in performing our routine activities as we do. So in other words, most of what we do rather automatically. And the brain kind of decides what it wants to do, but what it wants to do eventually has to tell, in most cases, has to tell the spinal cord what it wants to do, and then the spinal cord knows how to do it. For example, with the bladder, when you're born, your first couple of years, it's not your brain that's controlling the bladder. Your spinal cord already knows how to void when needed and defecate and so forth. And it's perfectly fine. It works beautifully. It's just not socially acceptable. Eventually, the brain gets involved. So the point is that the circuitry is still in the spinal cord, and we're trying to take advantage of this automaticity. So that's what we've been working on for decades, is to develop understand the physiology of how this is happening. And then we finally got to the point we said, okay, we're ready to try this in human subjects. And that's basically what we've been doing in the last, primarily the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we've had, I would say, generally consistent and pretty impressive results in taking advantage of this automaticity in the spinal cord. And so we had to develop some technology to do that. And that's where SpineX comes in. So yes, it has been really exciting, and we were going to learn a lot of science anyway of how we control our movement. But this is kind of really a bonus, is to be able to find out that we really can translate this new scientific knowledge into the clinical environment. And we've been so consistent in this, we're become very confident of the level of success that we can have with multiple pathologies and multiple types of trauma. We think we're just beginning to realize its potential.
Well, all right. So let's use something very specific, like voiding with the bladder. You're going to go through therapy. What's the end? The end point is, the patient can now void on demand. Is there some technology that's going to be there forever? Is it pushing a button? I'm help me to understand what it will look like when someone has used this, gone through the therapy, and is now at the endpoint for you?
Okay, that's a beautiful series of questions, and right on. And that's exactly what Parag has developed, primarily focusing initially on the bladder. And so, Parag, why don't you go through that and tell them about the changes that occur in the spinal cord injured complete injury patients?
Bladder is an interesting organ. It has three functions: to fill the bladder up to a certain point, to tell the brain that it is full, and then empty when it's socially acceptable. Now, after a trauma, spinal cord injury, stroke, and several other conditions, what people don't realize is that a person in a wheelchair is not just immobile, but also has lost functions, including bladder function. And what they lose is they lose the ability to sense a full bladder, so they just don't know how full their bladder is, unlike us. Second, they lose the ability to be continent, so they end up having leaks frequently. And third, they lose the ability to actually void voluntarily. Now, what we've demonstrated already so far in a large number of patients is after a patient has received therapy, they can we can improve multiple functions. One, they can have a much larger bladder capacity. So instead of going to the restroom every hour, they can now go every 4 hours, every 5 hours, which has a direct impact on you know, quality of life, where now they can sleep for 4 hours without having to wake up every hour at night. They are able to reduce number of incontinence episodes by over 70% within 8 weeks of therapy. Third, patients that have lost sensation can actually now sense that their bladder is full. So even if they're dependent on a catheter to empty their bladder, they normally would be catheterizing based on the clock. They can now catheterize based on sensation, which is far more cleaner as well as convenient for them. And finally, depending on the pattern of stimulation, we can actually get them to voluntarily void. So the way this functions from protocol perspective is we deliver the therapy an hour a day, a few days a week. And at the end of the period, there are what's called neural plasticity that's occurring in the spinal cord and brain, where each of these is occurring, thereby patient is not dependent on the device for improved function. But we always know that they perform better when the stimulation or the therapy is being delivered. So the way it's being designed is that this device could be made available to patients in the home environment, where they could self-deliver the therapy for an extended period of time, and then use it as needed based on whether they are, you know, sitting around in the couch and, you know, working so they can be continent, or if they need to use the restroom, you know, use it while they're, you know, trying to void or trying to defecate.
So you're in effect, you are actually taking advantage of neuroplasticity and reconnecting the brain to the spinal cord to the bladder.
And that's exactly what the intention is. We want the brain, spinal cord, and bladder to function as one, you know, in unison, as one system.
It's amazing. It's amazing. So Reggie, tell me about the what is it about neurobiology that, I mean, you know, we've discovered in our lifetime this tremendous neuroplasticity in the brain. And what I hear you saying is that neuroplastic ability extends throughout the body. And is that true?
Absolutely. One of the first things we learned when we got on this in this direction was we asked whether the spinal cord can learn. And we found out that we could teach an animal after a complete transection of the spinal cord. We could treat the animal to step with the hindquarters completely independently, but we had to train them. In other words, after the spinal cord was sectioned, it had to go through some plastic changes in order to learn how to do that. And initially, obviously, they can't do it. But when you step and every movement that you make, there's a tremendous amount of sensory information that goes back to the spinal cord. And what we found out that these neurons within the spinal cord can relearn how to process that sensory information, often referred to as proprioception. And after the animals are trained for a few weeks, they can learn to step and step full weight bearing and step over a range of speeds. They can even step backwards and sideways. So the spinal circuitry can learn all of these tasks. And what this told us eventually is this is really what happens normally when we are training. Even a person that's not injured, this plasticity is occurring when you're learning a motor task, for example. So it's pretty clear, and I think generally acceptable now, that the spinal cord can learn. And we often refer to it, even though most people think the spinal cord is just a cable that transfers all the information from the brain to the periphery. But now we know that it's much more than that. It has these, basically the spinal cord is simply an extension of the brain. And so it works pretty much in the same way from a number of aspects. So that's what we're really trying to take advantage of, this extensive plasticity. And the fact that really the spinal cord is smart enough to interpret all of this proprioception so that it knows exactly what to do. And one more point, you can think of this as first the information goes to the spinal cord, and then the spinal cord tells the brain what is happening. So the spinal cord knows even before the brain does exactly what's happening. And I always make a joke is the spinal cord is just being nice to the brain to tell it what it already knows it's going to do.
Right. Well, all right. So I'm curious, when you say the spinal cord learns after trauma, and you specifically, I heard you say that you cut the spinal cord in your animal testing,
right?
Correct. All right. So when you say it learns, is it that the neurons are reconnecting? Is it that new neurons are being created? Or is it that it's going outside and creating a whole new connection? What's the physiological impact of what you're doing?
Well, those are very important questions. When we first started this, we were going with the hypothesis that the neurons within the spinal cord knew how to step. They could be taught how, they could relearn how to step. And see, the transection is just stopping the flow of information back and forth from the spinal cord to the brain. But in almost all the spinal cord injuries, it's only an injury of a few segments. And so everything below the injury maintains a lot of its function, most of it. And of course, everything above is okay. So the challenge is to get something across. Now, at first, we thought we would only have the advantage of the neurons below the lesion that we could work with. We're figuring out how smart they are, and we can get a lot of function from that. But what we found out is something else when we started working with the human subjects that is turning out to be extremely important. And that is, most of the injuries that are considered complete in humans, we're finding that basically they're not complete as we have generally thought. In other words, there is some connectivity that's left in most of the injuries, because very rarely is there an injury where there's a complete transection like we do in the lab. And that within those few transections, there's neurons that can kind of remake connections. And that's what we have not realized until we started this procedure. But now what is happening is when we stimulate, we think we're stimulating, we know that we're initiating new connections when we stimulate. And so what we're doing is getting this reconnected. And then once it gets reconnected, it has to relearn how to step. because the connections are not going to be identical to what they were originally. Uh-huh. And so what we're finding out is that between the brain and the spinal cord, it knows how to get reconnected. Mm-hmm. And then with the stimulation, and so the other thing that's important here, we've talked about training and learning. Mm-hmm. And that is, so there's two things happening. One is to stimulate, and that kind of gets the spinal cord and the circuitry excited and make it possible to do these things, but it doesn't know exactly what to do. So we have to train it what to do. And so there's two aspects. One is what we call neuromodulation. So we're changing the excitability, but then once it's excited, we have to train it to so it can relearn how to do it. And so that demands rehabilitation. So that means rehabilitation is extremely important. So there's what we refer to as a use-dependent phenomenon. In other words, you use it or you lose it. Yes. That phenomenon is really present in this situation. The bladder has to relearn. The all of the muscle groups have to relearn. The heart has to relearn. Everything has to relearn because the circuitry is different.
Well, now let's take something very specific as the bladder, because we talked about children, newborns.
Right.
All right. Now, apparently they have to learn how to do these things.
That's right.
All right. So when you talk about rehabilitation because of trauma, is that similar to what the child is learning? Would we call that habilitation, not rehabilitation? But is the child actually learning in a similar path, a similar manner to what is going on with the rehabilitation effort?
That's another very good question. Yes, it has to learn, but it has intrinsically to the development of the neurons in the early in the neonatal stage, it has guidance molecules to kind of tell the neurons how to get connected. Now, sometimes that does not occur, and that's where we have these disorders in children. And so that's one of the things we're very interested in. And we've started working with cerebral palsy, for example, and finding that this same intervention is having a major effect in cerebral palsy and helping these connections to get reformed. And again, rehabilitation is important in that case too. Just stimulation is not enough. You have to work with the nervous system to retrain it.
So the device that you are creating is stimulating with electrical waveforms?
Right.
And then that causes the excitation, and then you can train.
That's correct.
And you're retraining in this particular case.
Right. So once you get it excited, that's what we see when you're young and just in that neonatal stage, your plasticity in your nervous system is extensive, right? And that's referred to as a critical period in your development of all of your organ systems. And so we think what we're doing is the stimulation is transforming the nervous system back towards something like this critical period.
You're recreating that ability.
Yeah, it's training the ability. So we use the terms that we think are very important in understanding the fundamentals here. You can stimulate and actually induce some of these movements, but we don't want the stimulator to induce the movement. We want to enable it. Yep. So that the brain can come in and you can move when you want to.
I'd like to add a point there. The way I try to describe it in terms of an analogy is it's a combination of a spinal pacemaker, where there's a constant tone being generated in the spinal cord, which gets the circuits going, and a hearing aid, where the hearing aid acts as an amplifier of signals going from the periphery through the spinal cord up to the brain, and bidirectionally from the brain so that the periphery can hear what the brain wants it to say. So that's how the enabling comes into picture. As if it's being induced, then the brain is being bypassed. So you're completely dependent on the stimulator in the long run.
Right. Because when I think of that neonate, I see a lot of learning going on there. And often that's the parents or caregivers holding the child's hands while they begin to learn to walk. So there is the learning that happens there. I see a similar kind of learning going on. We call it rehabilitation, but it's and unless you tell me differently, I'm assuming that it's not a lot different in terms of the physiological training and learning that goes on between the neonate and the patient being rehabilitated.
Basically, the concept is the same. The magnitude of the control from the intrinsic properties of the spinal cord is different in the neonate, obviously. For example, and others have been involved in space flight experiments. And how important is gravity in helping to develop your movement skills, for example? And what was found is that the animals that were born in space, and when they came back, their neuromuscular system was significantly impaired. Because every animal and every organism has grown up in space with not in space, but grown up with the gravitational environment. So we're built to function in a gravitational environment. So the point is that the activity of the system is an important factor in normal development.
Amazing. You guys are awesome. Awesome. I want to turn a little bit, Parag. I want you to talk about the business aspect. How did you two meet? And you know, to the extent that you're comfortable, talk to us about the path from that meeting to where you are now looking for a Series A, right?
Yeah, so Reggie and I have been working closely for the last almost 13 years now. So I actually did my PhD with Reggie at UCLA and finished up in 2013. And he jokes around quite a bit about this, but I think he's serious that he's got a stimulator implanted in me. And if I go beyond a certain radius of the lab, I'm pulled back. But on a more serious note, once I finished up, I didn't know anything else better to do. So I decided to carry on as a full-time scientist with him. So I have a dual role, one as a researcher at UCLA with Reggie, and a second to lead the commercial effort at Spinex. So Spinex was founded in late 2018, early 2019, when we realized that our technology was at a point where we knew the impact it has on patients, but it was limited to small clinical studies that we were running in the lab. And to really have the larger impact, it had to go through a commercial effort for it to be approved by the regulatory bodies to make it available to patients worldwide. The second aspect that we realized is bladder is an important organ system that a statistic that really blew our minds was that it impacts about 25% of the world's population, which is a huge, huge number of patients that could benefit from this. So urinary incontinence in general is a very large dysfunction. It impacts about 30 plus million Americans itself. So as we started running our studies, we realized that the market opportunity here goes beyond just trauma and spinal cord injury. So that's how Spinex came into formation. The business opportunity here is actually quite big, where we could potentially impact about 40 million Americans, including ones that have urinary incontinence due to natural conditions such as postpartum, or in males due to enlarged prostate, or just other natural conditions, along with the neurogenic spinal cord injury and stroke patients. With essentially the same device, the same protocol, we could improve their quality of lives. That's our first foray into the regulatory space and making it available to patients. Beyond that, we see applications, cerebral palsy, Parkinson's, stroke, spinal cord injury, wherein we know we can treat the whole body. And this is something that we have not touched upon. But the fact that this approach is non-invasive and that the same device can be used for multiple indications, it allows us to just move the electrode up and down the spine since you can just put patch electrodes. So the same device for a quadriplegic who's lost hand and arm function as well as lower extremity function could be used to improve all aspects of the body. So the basic drive for us here is that we want to treat the whole organism and not a single end organ. So from a business perspective, each of these would be a separate clinical study that would need to be conducted to gain FDA approval.
I want to stop you there, because what I hear is the tremendous value and the market, which sounds enormous, 14 million people. And those are all very exciting. In my experience, an investor in a Series A is certainly stirred by that. But the second piece that he's looking for is the management team, the quality of the management team. So talk to me about the management team that will bring this together.
So we have a small but really dedicated team that's driving Spinex, led by Reggie and myself. We have Mr. Derek Herrera, who's actually based in Orange County. He's a former Navy vet who got injured while serving in Afghanistan due to a gunshot wound he suffered. But since then, he's gone on to get an MBA from UCLA, and that's where he and I met. So he's leading a lot of our business development efforts. He's a serial entrepreneur himself, leading another medical device company based in Orange County. And has the experience on the medical device side. We have Dr. Evgeny Kraden, who is a urologist based out of USC. So we have our, as the chief medical officer. And finally, we have Mr. Tim Hopper, a healthcare executive with over 25 years of experience leading medical devices through various stages of development. Mm-hmm. Along with that, we have engaged with regulatory consultants, Experian Group based in Northern California, who provide us all the regulatory and quality support that is required.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. It sounds like you are on the way. That's exciting. Yeah, it's very exciting. Those 14 million people out there are all praying for you to succeed. What can we do to help you? What would be helpful?
I think we have a couple of roadblocks in front of us that we need to cross to meet the next milestone, which is, the next major milestone, which is getting FDA approval. And one of those is the funds that are required. And we're currently we have NIH grants for SBIR grants, phase two applications that are being processed. We're hoping some of those will be funded. In parallel, we have discussions ongoing with potential VCs, angel investors, to raise this $5 to $7 million round that the CDCA that we talked about. So I think if some of those come through as planned, then that would really set our path straight to go from, gain the milestone, which is getting FDA approval, as well as initiating the studies for cerebral palsy and Parkinson's in parallel.
So you have a way to come up with your $5 to $7 million in hand right now on the way?
We have had initial discussions with a few VC groups who have shown interest. One of our agendas is, once we hear back from some of our NIH grants in the next couple of months, is engage with these VC groups or strategics in a more serious manner to see what level of funding would they be willing to provide over the next 6 months or so. We currently have a small grant through a foundation that's supporting us, along with a small pre-seed round that we raised in 2019. That's provided all the financial support for the Good. Product development and clinical studies.
Well, I hope you will take this recording and use it in any way that would be helpful to let people know what's going on, because I'm not a neurobiologist, but it certainly sounds very intriguing and very, very encouraging. And at the same time, it sounds like you have covered the bases with some very experienced management folks to help to bring this to FDA approval. So how could people contact you if they wanted to talk more?
You can contact either Reggie or myself. I'm happy to share my email. It would be Parag@spinex.co. You can send me an email, and we're happy to talk to anyone.
Parag at spinex.co.
That's correct.
All right. So very good. Well, that's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear all of this wonderful, wonderful biomedical research that's coming to be applied, especially, I mean, when Christopher Reed suffered his paraplegia and dedicated himself to helping to fix that, I thought that was a dream. But now I'm beginning to see that because of you, Reggie, and Parag, that this is not that far off. That's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, we were one of the first ones to put Christopher Reeve on a treadmill.
Really?
Yeah. And it was really amazing. It was amazing. He was so excited.
Wow. Wow. Well, thank you for the great work that you're doing. And thank you, Parag, for your efforts to bring it into application. That's wonderful. Here we are. One more example of how business, and in this case, academia and the far reaches of neurobiology in California are thriving.
You've been listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.